Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSR HealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to HealthyLife.net, positive talk radio. I'm Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and welcome to Health Freedom Now. Keeping our health freedom of choice alive is even more important now that television and print media is normalizing the state of obesity. At its last count, the CDC estimated that 40% of U.S. adults, 21% of teens, and 14% of preschoolers are obese. A December 2019 study concluded that half of U.S. adults would be obese by the year 2030. Worse, people don't get the recommended exercise every day. And when they presented people who lived in so-called food deserts with healthy options, only 10% changed their eating habits. What are we to do? The rising rates of obesity has led to significant increases in the prevalence and incidence of type 2 diabetes worldwide. Today, we're going to talk about the causes of the obesity epidemic and, most importantly, what we, doctors and patients, can do about it. I am so honored to have Dr. Daniel Weiss. He's an endocrinologist and physician nutrition specialist in St. George, Utah. Dr. Weiss earned his medical degree at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. He completed an internal medicine residency followed by a fellowship in endocrinology at the University of Iowa. And he is a diploma of the American Board of Obesity Medicine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Weiss.
Thank you, Dr. Singleton. Thank you for the honor to be joining you in this challenging topic.
Well, you're the one to talk about it, so let's just get started. What do you think is the cause of worldwide obesity, and specifically in the United States?
Well, I wish I had the answer to that, but I think one can probably most accurately describe this as multifactorial. I think for many of us in the West, food is generally lower cost, although we're seeing prices rising. It's often calorie-dense, and many people have the ability to get their food, get their meds, and be inactive, not, you know, drive everywhere, sit in front of their screens, and not engage in regular physical activity for whatever reason. And so they have excess calories taken in and less expended. That's the overall kind of view, but there's probably other factors that are not well understood, changes in the gut microbiome for a variety of reasons, and there's unknowns too. Certainly there's more medications that are prescribed that might have weight gain as a side effect. Some of those are antidepressants. Some of those are sometimes antipsychotics that are used for depression that will increase appetite. So there are a lot of factors, and there's genetic factors. But people are often have sedentary existences and access to food that's calorie dense. So those are all contributors to the weight gain that we're seeing, especially as people get older, and even now, as you described, in youth. And this is a major challenge to overall health.
Well, I tell you, all the things you've named, when you talked about sedentary, even getting our food, people are using Uber Eats and what Instacart. They don't even go out to get the food anymore. So it makes it even worse. And then when we get it, it's processed food, which can't help. What do you think?
That's right. And, you know, in many cases, their only activity might be going out to the store, going to a big box store. And that's their activity. And they bring home large supplies of lower cost, calorie dense foods in bulk quantities. And often meals are not balanced, and people are not eating low calorie foods, and they may be drinking sugar sweetened drinks. That's a contributor to central weight gain around the girth. And so people have this conception that diet drinks are bad, and so and better to drink sugar sweetened beverages. That's very foolish and not supported by good science. And when they drink those sugar sweetened beverages as a significant source of their calorie intake, that tends to promote weight gain, fatty liver, and all those associated conditions that come with weight gain.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the sugar sweetened drinks. I can't tell you how many times I'm in the grocery store and see people with 12 packs of Cokes and Sprite and whatnot hanging over the edge of the grocery cart. And I'm thinking, my goodness, you're going to drink all that? It's what happened to water.
Yes, that's right. Two liters sweetened beverages. And, yeah, so it's there's lots of misconceptions too about food choices and meal frequency, and those people who try to lose think that maybe eating even when they're not hungry is important. Eating maybe six times a day might help them, so that's based upon there's no good science. And actually, it's fine to skip a meal. I encourage people if they're struggling with their weight, it's okay to not eat if you're not hungry. I encourage them to do that. And it's fine to skip breakfast. They don't have to have breakfast. There's still, people are getting even advice from some registered dietitians saying, oh, you have to have breakfast. It's so important. It's nonsense. And, so to tell people, you must eat even when you're not hungry. And there are people who they'll tell me, and you've probably seen this in your practice, if I eat breakfast, then that messes me up for the whole day. I just end up eat excessively. And there are others who feel they have to have the breakfast, and that's fine. But so I encourage people, if they're not a breakfast eater, fine. Don't start, because that's not going to It's not going to help you lose weight. You don't want to.
Well, it's funny you said that. I'm one of those people that if I eat breakfast, it seems to make me hungrier for the rest of the day than if I don't.
There's something about it. It may seem counterintuitive, but eating can make you hungrier. I mean, food tastes good, so it's hard to control portions for all of us. For most people, there are people who, of course, who, when they're anxious, they don't eat. Those are slim people. There's not many of those. Most people, when they're anxious and stressed, they often, and they may have learned this as a child, they turn to food. They might have been you know, if they were upset, their mom said, we'll get you an ice cream. Here's a candy bar. Let's, you know, so food becomes a source of solace, of a means to kind of feel better. And they, as an adult, they continue that. So that's a factor too. So eating is complicated. But yes, a key point is, if you're really not hungry, try to listen to yourself. If you're not hungry, don't eat. And it's perfectly fine to skip a meal. And two or three meals a day is fine. Yes.
One of the things there, when you mention that, if you're not hungry, don't eat, and something I find, and I'm sure a lot of other people do, is boredom can make you eat.
Yes, absolutely. So boredom, stress, anxiety, the kind of mindless eating when you eat and it's food's in front of you. And so there's actually studies looking at this, and this relates to behavioral changes one can make when one tries to control weight and is struggling with weight loss. So trying to be conscious of eating, not have eating distracted. Try to focus on eating, not, you know, if you eat and you're watching television, you can keep eating while you're watching and you're just stuffing your face and, you know, and the amount, the size of the whatever the food is in, how much food, if you have a big container with lots of food, you tend to keep eating until you see the bottom. And that's why using smaller glasses, putting things in smaller bowls, on smaller plates, it makes it seem like you're getting more, and then you go back for refills rather than having the food right in front of you. There was a study done, interestingly, where they looked at candy placed, and this is kind of pretty obvious. You think the conclusions would be obvious. But candy placed in front of a person in the office as opposed to 12 feet away, and they measured how much was consumed. And it's pretty, you can figure it out. If it's close to you, it's so convenient. Or you keep grabbing and you eat more. But if you have to walk 12 feet to get the candy, you're not going to eat as much. And that's why, you know, that's the same. And that relates to, if you drive past the donut shop, and you go take that route, and you see those donuts, and you're more likely to pick up donuts in the morning. Maybe go a different route so you're not past the donut shop. And that can be a helpful approach to deal with that challenge. And there are other behavioral interventions one can use. When you go grocery shopping, try not to shop when you're hungry. You tend to, I'll try this. I'll get this for the grandkids. I'll get this for my kids. Oh, they like those. And then you eat them too. So, you know, if you're not hungry, you're less likely to put those things that you're like, less likely to have impulsive purchases. Shopping from a list. Make the list when you're not hungry. And go to the grocery store after you're working from your list. Try not to deviate from that. So it helps, because these are controlling eating, and it's difficult. And if you bring the stuff in, if you bring whatever it is into the house that's somewhat like junk that maybe you don't need, that's calorie dense, you're not going to throw it out. You'll eat it.
I think you're so right about not throwing it out once you have it. And after it's home and you look at it, you think, I should have never bought that bag of chips. But at $5 a bag, you're not going to throw it away.
Right. Or if you're going to buy it, you buy a small bag, you know. Or you buy a quart of ice cream, not a gallon. You know, so those are some of the choices you can make. And then you can try to make it easier for you to restrain yourself. It's because it's so challenging when delicious food or food that you tend to enjoy eating, whatever it might be, candy bars or chips or so on, is in front of you, you're going to consume it. And that's, there was a person, I had a patient some years ago who said, and she actually had diabetes, she had type 1 diabetes, and there would people would. She said, "Well, people bring these things into the office, and it's so hard. It's just junk, you know. And they bring it in every day, and it messes my sugar up." And she had some challenges with weight, but not as many as much as a person with type 2 diabetes would have. And I said, "Well, who's in charge of people bringing things in? Who's the supervisor?" She said, "Well, I am." I said, "Okay. How about a rule? You only can bring stuff into the office, you know, donuts and cookies and those kinds of things, one day a week." So she created that rule, and it was enforced, and so it made it easier for her, because most people would end up going by the kitchen where those things were, and it made it less challenging for her to deal with that temptation.
That is really good advice. Well, what do you think about exercise? Some people say exercise doesn't matter. Some people say it does. And it's not like you can stationary bicycle all the pie you just ate. You know, is it the calories or is it the act of exercising? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's hard to burn up. It's much easier to... You're not gonna make up for those excess calories very well by just 30 minutes on the cycle. Or, I mean, if you're working out for hours, which most people are not gonna do, if you're a construction worker and you're working 8 hours a day and you're digging ditches, well, sure, that's a lot of calorie expenditure, but most exercise, is not going to, allow you to consume calories ad libitum. So you really still, in order to lose weight, exercise will not be sufficient. It's helpful. It's good. Exercise is good for most everything. Otherwise, it's good for heart health, sleep, energy, brain, anxiety, and more. And it'll improve insulin action, so it tends to help with sugar control. So it's good, and it can make it so that when you're trying to lose weight, you lose a little less muscle than you would lose if you don't exercise. So if you're a couch potato and you're really trying to lose weight, you can do so without any exercise at all, and you just cut down enough on calories, but you're going to lose about 10% more muscle than you would if you were exercising. And why is that important? Well, because if the more muscle you retain at the end of the period of weight loss, the more easy it is to maintain that weight, because muscle burns a lot of calories. That's why men tend to lose more easily than women, because their calorie requirements are higher. They have more muscle mass. So we want to keep as much muscle mass as possible. So by exercising, even just walking, muscle toning type light weights, but walking, cycling, stationary cycle, those kinds of things can help us keep that muscle at its maximum while we're pursuing efforts to lose weight. Now, any effort, any weight loss is going to be still 70 to 80% of that, the weight that's lost, 70 to 80% is fat. It's 70% fat and about 30 and some of that's muscle, about 20% muscle if you're not exercising, but it's more like 80% fat if you are exercising. So you want to minimize muscle loss and maximize fat loss, and you can do that while you're cutting down on calories by exercising. So, yeah, exercise will not, you know, people will come and say, "Oh, you know, I'm exercising every day and I'm not losing." Well, you're not going to burn a whole lot of calories up while you're exercising. Even 30 minutes, 40 minutes, it's not a lot. And you can make you have a couple pieces of cheese and you already consume the calories you burned up. So you really have to cut down on calorie intake, and that's challenging.
Yes, it is. Now, the AMA has decided, and they said obesity is a disease. So is it a disease or is it a symptom of other conditions?
I think it's a chronic disease. I think that's an accurate description, but, you know, it has multiple causes, and it contributes to many other conditions. Osteoarthritis, where all these people needing knee replacements because they've been carrying this weight for years that their knees can't sustain. More fatty liver disease, and some of those people get end-stage liver disease and liver failure because of years of fatty liver and inflammation in their liver. Type 2 diabetes, higher blood pressure, high triglycerides, all those are conditions that are more likely to occur in those people who are overweight or obese. So I think it is a chronic disease, and it's a challenging one to treat, and it's not something you can treat with a short course of intervention. It's a lifelong intervention.
Well, this is good for people to hear, because it's like having high blood pressure, if you just have it, whether you're obese or not, you've got to work on it all the time, every day. And it seems like with our massive food supply and ads on television or always these calorie-rich foods, it seems like everything is working against us. So we've got to work for ourselves to keep our weight in order, just to keep the rest of our health in order. When we come back from the break, I'd like to talk about lots of things. We've got these new drugs we're hearing about on TV. But before we begin that, I'd like you to go in and explain type 1 and type 2 diabetes and how it's measured and how we tell if people have it and that sort of thing. And we'll get into that after the break.
Will do.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does, especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at AutismSpeaks.org, brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Faucet running? That's not a faucet. That's a river rushing through the forest. Forest rivers provide over 100 million people with clean water to drink.
What? I can't hear you because of the vacuum.
That's not a vacuum. That's the trees in the forest cleaning up the air we breathe.
I didn't know the trees were so amazing.
Yep, and the forest gives us shade, trees to climb.
That's awesome. Let's go explore some more.
Visit the forest today and enjoy all it does, just for you. To learn more about the forest and find one near you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
This is a book every woman needs to put into their home library. Women's Body, Women's Wisdom by Christiane Northrup, M.D. covers the entire range of women's health from the first menstrual period through menopause and everything in between. This fully updated version includes the very latest treatment and research data combining new technologies with natural remedies and the miraculous healing powers within the body itself. It's one of the best medical reference books on women's health, and you can get Women's Body, Women's Wisdom by Christiane Northrup, M.D. at Amazon.com.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Sterling, and I know what it's like to struggle with mental health issues. If you have a friend that's going through a tough time, now's the perfect moment to reach out. Learn how to start the conversation at seizetheawkward.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the Jed Foundation.
Uplifting Talk, HealthyLife.net.
Before the break, I was talking to Dr. Dan Weiss, and we were talking about obesity in general. And we all hear the connection with diabetes, but we hear type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes. Doctor, can you tell us the difference and how doctors and people figure it out when they have it?
Well, most people with diabetes have type 2 diabetes. So this used to be called adult onset, but that terminology is now, I think, more accurately described as just type 2. So with type 2 diabetes, that's about 90%, 85, 90% of the diabetes that is seen in this country. And those persons who have type 2 diabetes do not have any immune attack on their insulin-producing cells. That's not the problem. Those people, they make insulin. Insulin is that main hormone from the pancreas that controls the blood sugar. They make insulin, but that insulin doesn't work that well. So they're said to have insulin resistance, which means their tissues respond less to the insulin. Now, most of 85% of those people with type 2 diabetes are overweight or obese. They have usually extra weight around their abdomen, and their insulin doesn't work as well. They make insulin. And that diabetes that they have usually runs in the family, and to the extent that they can exercise and lose some weight, doesn't have to be a lot. Often it's 5% of their weight, 10% of their baseline weight, their blood sugar control will improve. Blood sugar control is important because high sugar, even though it may not give you symptoms from the high sugar itself, the high glucose in blood, over years, it damages the eyes, nerves, and kidneys. So the main cause of kidney failure in this country is diabetes, uncontrolled diabetes that had been uncontrolled for years. And then there's a major cause of adult blindness in this country is also diabetes, uncontrolled. So that's type 2 diabetes. And so the majority of people who have diabetes have type 2 diabetes, and that we don't call it adult onset because you can be 12 and have it, 12 years old, and it's not. And again, it's the type 1 and type 2 is confusing. They used to use Roman numerals, now they're using Arabic numbers. So type 1 diabetes, on the other hand, is autoimmune. So your immune system has been going against attacking your insulin-producing cells, usually for years before the diabetes shows up. And those people with type 1 diabetes usually are not overweight, or even if they are, because lots of people are overweight, and they can be overweight and have type 1 diabetes, if they lose weight, it doesn't fix their sugar because they're not making sufficient insulin. The insulin usually works fine. They're not insulin resistant if they have type 1 diabetes, but their insulin producing cells are getting pooped out, basically. They have been attacked and destroyed by their immune system. And why that is not clear. But certainly it's interesting, just as an aside, we've seen people with new onset type 1 diabetes after COVID and COVID shots. And that's because they affect the immune system, contrary to what my mainstream physicians are willing to admit. So I've seen new onset type 1 diabetes after that. I've seen thyroid problems coming after COVID and COVID shots. So that's an immune kind of thing. And those people with type 1 diabetes, you know, you can't say, oh, if you lose weight, it's going to get better, because it doesn't matter. And so now sometimes we see people, they come into our office and they were told they had type 2. And I've seen this just here over the last year in my practice here in Utah. People were said to have type 2 diabetes and their sugar's not controlled with all these different medicines for type 2 diabetes. I look at them and I think, I wonder if he got type 1 diabetes. So the person with type 1 diabetes, the main treatment is insulin, because remember, their insulin-producing cells are not making enough. So they need insulin as the main intervention. And these other things like metformin and the once-a-week shots, they're not going to help. And so there's a test you can do that's usually helpful in distinguishing type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and that's a measurement of antibodies. It's like when we make antibodies to infection, you can measure an antibody that is usually seen in type 1 diabetes, and that's it. It's got an abbreviation called GAD, G-A-D, anti-glutamic acid decarboxylase antibodies. Those people with type 1 diabetes, about 85% of them have antibodies. And so that's a very helpful test. A lot of doctors aren't aware of it. They'll do other measurements, or they just overlook the fact that, yeah, there's people with type, with diabetes, and sometimes we're not sure. And if you're not sure, usually those antibodies are present in type 1 and they're not present in type 2 diabetes.
So doctor, could you say the name of that test again so people can jot it down, because they might have to suggest it to their doctor?
Absolutely. Anti-GAD. It's anti-GAD antibody. So the reason we abbreviate it is because it stands for glutamic acid decarboxylase antibodies. But if you say anti-GAD antibodies, they should know that. And so that's very helpful. And there are other kinds of diabetes, but those are the two main types. And the person with type 1 diabetes, if they don't take their insulin, they can get really sick, have a life-threatening problem called ketoacidosis. People with type 2 diabetes do not tend to get that. And people with type 2 diabetes, we have all these medicines you see all advertised for treatment that generally are not used in type 1 diabetes. So people on insulin pumps are more often have type 1 diabetes, and we use insulin, and it's more challenging, but the technology's gotten much better for treating type 1 diabetes.
The test we hear about before the break, can we just quickly go over what is an A1C test? That's what you hear people talking about in these ads. Oh, my A1C is down.
Yes. So glucose sticks onto the hemoglobin in red blood cells in everyone. Hemoglobin's in the red blood cells. It carries the oxygen. So everyone has some glucose stuck onto the hemoglobin. It has a chemical reaction. It produces something called hemoglobin A1C. Well, the higher the glucose is over the past few months, the more you'll have the hemoglobin A1C produced. The red blood cells live, we're always making new cells for lots of the skin lining of our esophagus, our food tube, our esophagus, and there's new red blood cells made. They last about 90 days, each red blood cell, and during that 90 days, the 3 months, glucose is stuck onto the hemoglobin. So we can get an idea over the past 3 months how your sugar has been doing, because the higher your sugar is, the more the hemoglobin A1C.
Well, thank you for that explanation. That's one of those terms that gets thrown around, but I don't think very many people, even some doctors, don't even really understand what it means. After the break, I'd like to talk about all these new drugs, Ozempic and Mounjaro and Wegovy, and how do they work, and what do you use them for, and all those sorts of things, side effects. And so I'd love to get into that after the break.
Keyboard Cat, Hamilton the Pug, and Toast Meets World. These are some of the Internet's most beloved pets. And they all have one thing in common. Their stories started in a shelter. Start your story. Adopt a dog or cat today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Training that pet to play the keyboard, that's optional. Start a story. Adopt a shelter or rescue pet today. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
So what's a great way to spread awareness that driving high is illegal everywhere? A catchy song, of course.
You can run, but you can't drive high. You can run, but you can't drive high.
Friendly reminder, don't drive high. If you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to mom. I had no idea how hard it would be and what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and ways for me to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics, but also information about the hurdles I was facing. Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The Bright Side of Talk. HealthyLife.net.
Before the break, we were talking with Dr. Dan Weiss about obesity and diabetes and all these things that we kind of don't want to think about, but we have to. So all over the television, they're advertising these new drugs, Ozempic, and I even have that terrible little ditty in my brain that I can't get rid of about Ozempic and Mounjaro. So, Doctor, tell us about them. What are they? How do they work? And what are the side effects? Are they pills? Are they injections? So much to know.
Right. So this class of drugs was discovered some years ago when there was a researcher looking at the saliva of a Gila monster. And so the first drug in this kind of in this class of injected incretin, I-N-C-R-E-T-I-N, incretin mimetics, was a drug called exenatide or Byetta. And that was injected twice a day. It caused a lot of nausea, and it had the effect of all drugs in this class to improve amount of insulin that someone makes if they need it, but not if they don't. That is, if their sugar was high, then you would make insulin in response to this medicine. And it would also lower the production of a hormone called glucagon, which tends to raise your sugar. So you want less of that. And the action of these agents is to also reduce appetite and to slow stomach emptying. So over time, there's been an evolution and a modification and studying of these molecules. So all of them, basically, when we eat, there's production of a hormone from some cells in our intestine called that hormone, that chemical, is called glucagon-like peptide 1 or GLP-1. And what it does is all those things I just mentioned. Makes you make insulin, lowers glucagon, slows stomach emptying, and reduces appetite. And reduces appetite by working in the brain. There's places in the brain where GLP-1, that hormone from those cells in the intestine, binds. So there's a sort of gut-brain axis. So researchers have been able to do is they've looked at the structure of our own body's GLP-1. We make this. And again, from the L cells of the intestine, GLP-1 is made. And it's a protein made up of building blocks called amino acids. And they've modified some of those amino acids so that now the that once weekly product called semaglutide, marketed as Ozempic or Wegovy, it lasts basically a week. You can dose it weekly as a shot. It binds to those receptors, so it works like your own body's GLP-1, but it's hanging around for a whole week instead of 90 seconds, which is what it would do if it was your natural GLP-1. And it reduces appetite. It won't make your sugar go too low because of how it works. So it can be given to people without diabetes. And the side effects of these medications is nausea, queasiness, any medication that reduces appetite. Sure, it can make you nauseated, but it can give you diarrhea. Sometimes you get constipation. Most people, the vast majority of people, tolerate it, do fine with it. There's about 3 to 5% who just can't take it. But so they've studied it initially with diabetes, and then they found, look at this, they tend to lose weight, and then they started studying it in people without diabetes who just were struggling with their weight, who had obesity. And so there are three injected medications that are in these type of this class that are actually officially approved by the FDA, for what that's worth, for obesity. So one is called Saxenda, and that is the version of Victoza or liraglutide for weight. So the FDA requires, if it's for weight and not for diabetes, you have to come up with a different name. That's what they do for lots of things. Or if it's used for something else, completely different, come up with a different name. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but that's the rule. So Wegovy is the same as Ozempic, but Wegovy is approved for weight. Ozempic is approved for diabetes. Mounjaro is a little different from these other drugs because it also binds. It's kind of more related to another hormone in the intestine called gastric inhibitory polypeptide. Doesn't really matter. It works in the same kind of way, and it's actually even more effective, Mounjaro, than Ozempic is, because there's head-to-head studies. It looks like it's for sugar control, it's better. It's also once a week. The side effects are similar, and it's even more effective for weight. Now it's just approved for weight loss. It's got a name called Zepbound. Unfortunately, the challenge with most of these meds is not the side effects, because it looks like they tend to be tolerated very well. The challenge is paying for them. So if you're really wealthy, sure, you can get those drugs. You can pay for them if your insurance isn't going to cover it. But a lot of insurances, because they don't get good deals, I guess, with the pharmaceutical companies, they make it so that it makes it very challenging to get coverage for them. So you know, we might want to put a person on Mounjaro, or even if they want to lose weight and they don't have diabetes, Zepbound or Wegovy. But their plan might say, oh, we're not covering any drugs for weight loss. So this is a problem because it's hard to lose. People can try all those behavioral methods. They could go to Nutrisystems and Weight Watchers and be really trying really hard, and they might not succeed in maintaining their weight loss or in losing that much. And the medications are helpful. This class of medicines is probably better, more effective for weight than some of the other stuff that we've had that are pills. But they're costly.
Well, this is one of those things, though, that sometimes a medicine that costs a lot would save you more money in the end. And it's one of the reasons so many times we harangue about insurance companies, that sometimes you're better off saving your money and having cash programs and having insurance just for catastrophic things like hospitalizations. because if they're not going to pay for it, even though they're too short-sighted to see that if somebody is consistently overweight, they're going to have heart troubles, et cetera, and ultimately cost more money. So here we are yet again that unintended consequences not looked at. After the break, we're going to talk some more about this and are there any downsides to these drugs and a few more things about obesity, diabetes, and just our general health. We'll do that after the break.
I know you care about your right to health freedom of choice, but we are under constant attack by industry-driven medical mandates. At MAM.org, you can be part of the solution to keep your rights to health freedom. MAM stands for Millions Against Medical Mandates, and your voice is heard and counted. Visit MAM.org, where doctors, lawyers, journalists, researchers, scientists, and people like you come together to keep our health freedom strong. Together, join the millions at MAM.org. That's MAMM.org.
Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone?
Do flowers have best friends?
I don't know.
Hey, look.
Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does. Especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
You're listening to CHSR Real Radio on the web.
Before the break, we were talking about these weight loss drugs that seem to be all the rage, and Dr. Weiss explained how they worked, and which was amazing because I didn't know that. I was really educated by that. Now, I do have one question. Okay, can you take any of these things in a pill, or do they have to be injections? And what are serious side effects? Are there heart side effects? Any reason why, let's say somebody has the money to pay for them, any reason they shouldn't use them?
Well, there's a box warning if a person has had a rare kind of thyroid cancer called medullary carcinoma of the thyroid or multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1. This is a box warning that comes from rodent findings. It's probably not at all significant in humans, but it's a caution, and the FDA advises not to give those drugs to people where there's a family history or personal history of this particular kind of thyroid cancer. It's not the common thyroid cancer. Other than that, people have had problems with slowed stomach emptying, and they're on medication for that. If they have a lot of gastrointestinal disease already, they would be people to use that with one of those medications with caution. But otherwise, you know, someone who has a lot of acid reflux, they can be sometimes worse. Usually it gets better with weight loss, even though some people might have a transient worsening in that acid reflux on the medications. But otherwise, no. The main obstacle would be cost. And there's, again, you know, 3 to 5% of people who have side effects, and they're mostly gastrointestinal side effects. I've had people who had severe constipation with them and severe diarrhea or bad nausea and vomiting. But, you know, again, that's a 95% of people, that's not an issue. But once you're on it, yeah, you can stop them at any point, but the tendency with anything is when we're treating a chronic condition, it's going to recur if you stop the medication. So the same thing with blood pressure. The blood pressure pills are not curing your blood pressure. They control it while you're taking it. When you stop it, your blood pressure goes back up. When you stop these medications, you'll tend to regain the weight. Unless you've made major changes and you really think, oh, I'm so active now and I'm so good with food choices, but the likelihood is you're going to regain the weight. That's what the data would show, would indicate. So it's a long proposition.
It seems to me it might be a good jump start. And so many times when people start to lose weight, they don't see anything right away, so they give up after a couple of weeks. But if you had something that helped show some result rather quickly, then you might be inspired to actually stay on behavioral changes later on, because I would hate to think you'd have to get these shots forever and ever and ever.
Doesn't
seem too palatable.
Yeah. So, well, most people do fine with them. The main unpalatable thing is if it's really pricey. Most people just their experience is very good with them. They feel better, and you know they've lost. You know, in the studies, for example, with tirzepatide in non-obese people, about 60% of people lost about 20% or more of their weight, which is amazing. And remember that none of these things are speeding up metabolism. So occasionally I'll have people come to me and say, I don't eat anything. You know, I eat so little. It's not worth arguing with them. And the point is not whether they eat a lot or a little. There's no value in challenging them on that, because if they're not losing, even if they're eating very little, the medication really just help you eat less. They don't speed up metabolism. None of these medications are revving up your metabolism. That's what your exercise is for. So they're really just making it so you're even less hungry or you're satisfied with less food. And because if you're not losing, and you're maintaining your weight, you're in steady state. You're taking in and burning up about the same.
Well, this is so good to know, and I think this comes up a lot. I have to say one of my guilty pleasures is 600-pound life, and all those people tell the surgeon, but I'm not eating anything. And, you know, well, one, it's kind of hard to believe, but even if that were true, what you're saying, you've got to get your metabolism going, too. You can't just sit around and expect everything to change. But we've been kind of lulled into that way of life, though.
Yes, and even with, you know, with bariatric surgery, when they're doing that, it's working. We don't understand fully how it's working, but it's principally working by having people eat less. It's not making you burn a lot of calories. So when they do a vertical sleeve gastrectomy and they're removing 80% of your stomach, you're eating much less. You're satisfied with really little food. So that's why you lose weight. Principally, that's the reason.
Well, when people have bariatric surgery, since I brought up my 600-pound life, and some of the people say they've had it once and quote-unquote, it failed, what is the failure? Does the stomach just stretch out again?
Yeah, well, you know, people can drink calories, and they can get through it. They can eat lots of ice cream or calorie dense kind of liquids, and that they can thwart it's a tool, but it's not a miracle. So you still have to have good food choices. Try to be active, and so the behavioral element is important. And probably, yes, over time, there is some stretching of the gas of that pouch over time, and if people can't still take in a lot of calories if they're not putting that effort in. But that's part of the whole selecting the right patient and educating them on the changes that they'll need to make lifelong.
Well, this is good to know. And in our last couple of minutes, I'd just like you to explain why people are dumping on the BMI, because that's what we see, and a lot of doctors will put that in the chart, and it automatically gets figured out, and there's BMI calculators on the Internet and all. What do you think about the BMI? Let's finish.
I think it's still very useful, and it's still a very good reflection of excess weight. And, you know, there are going to be exceptions. You have really muscular people who might have a high BMI, and they don't have a weight problem with excess fat. That's very infrequent. Most people, you could just look at them, you measure their BMI, and it's still a very useful indicator of the weight that they have and how it might contribute to associated disorders. So it's still very useful, and it shouldn't be dismissed. It's a very useful tool.
Well, thank you so much for all the information you've given us today, Dr. Weiss, and I hope that we'll have a chance to talk with you again.
Thank you, Dr. Singleton.
And remember, for all of our listeners, each patient carries his own doctor inside him. We are at our best when we give that doctor who resides in us a chance to work. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
This is a book every woman needs to put into their home library. Women's Body, Women's Wisdom by Christiane Northrup, M.D. covers the entire range of women's health from the first menstrual period through menopause and everything in between. This fully updated version includes the very latest treatment and research data combining new technologies with natural remedies and the miraculous healing powers within the body itself. It's one of the best medical reference books on women's health, and you can get Women's Body, Women's Wisdom by Christiane Northrup, M.D. at Amazon.com.
Dwayne Johnson here. The earthquakes you see in movies are one thing, but real life is a completely different animal. Just because you can't predict an earthquake doesn't mean that you can't prepare for one. In the event of a real earthquake, you should drop, cover, and hold on. Visit ready.gov/earthquake and practice what to do to keep you and your family safe in the event of a real earthquake, and you'll be seen as a hero by your family and your loved ones.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Where positive people and radio unite. HealthyLife.net.